From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the seductive moaning, crooning, and recitations of Barry White. The oversized, deep-voiced singer is the guru of love to some fans and entertaining camp to others. His hits of the 70s combine funk and disco. His hit, You're the First, the Last, My Everything, has been revived on Ally McBeal. Now he has a new CD and a new autobiography. Early in his career, he wrote songs about love for the female trio Love Unlimited, but when it came to singing himself, he was a reluctant performer. Also, Maureen Corrigan reviews Headlong, the new novel by British writer Michael Frayn. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Gunmen attacked the Armenian parliament today, killing the prime minister and at least six other top officials and lawmakers. The office of Armenia's president confirmed today that Prime Minister Vazgen Sarkissian and the Speaker of the Central Asian Republic's parliament were among the dead. The gunmen are reported to be holding about 30 parliamentary deputies and ministers hostage, demanding an escape helicopter and a chance to speak to the nation on television. At least two of the hostages have now been released. The Prime Minister and the Speaker were leaders of a coalition that won the most votes in a national election last spring. President Clinton condemned the killings and said the leaders were actively engaged in building democracy in their country. As the White House and Congress continue to spar over spending bills for the current fiscal year, the administration says the government closed the books on fiscal 1999 with a $123 billion surplus. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
The surplus was due to excess Social Security revenues. President Clinton and congressional Republicans all vowed they will not touch surplus Social Security funds this year. But to do that, Republicans say they must cut all government spending by about 1% across the board. Democrats say even a 1% cut will mean poor mothers and children will lose nutrition assistance and military personnel will lose their jobs. Republicans say nonsense. House Majority Whip Tom DeLay.
Even with this 1% cut, Republicans are still allocating $1.8 billion more to the military than what the president wanted.
If the measure calling for the 1% cut passes Congress, President Clinton is expected to veto it. Brian Naylor, NPR News, the Capitol.
In Northern Ireland, the chairman of the peace talks is beginning the most sensitive negotiation since the peace accord was signed. Former U.S. Senator George Mitchell has 3 days to bring rival political parties to a compromise. Marianne McGuire reports from Belfast.
George Mitchell's return has signaled the beginning of the last phase of the negotiations. The chairman of the peace talks will present the political parties with his suggestions on how to end the crisis. But there is already widespread skepticism that a deal can be found. Pro-British Ulster unionists continue to demand that the Irish Republican Army surrender weapons before the formation of a local government. The Irish Sinn Féin Party, for its part, insists that no such precondition exists in the agreement. The fragility of the peace process was once again highlighted last night when a pipe bomb exploded near the rural town of Dungannon. The incident was blamed on dissident loyalist pro-British paramilitaries opposed to the peace process. For NPR News, I'm Marianne McGuire in Belfast.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Industrials gained 93 points to close at 10,394. This is NPR News. Authorities in North Carolina are still searching for those who placed bombs in three Lowe's home improvement stores in North Carolina last month. Mark Rumsey of member station WFAE reports from Charlotte.
Federal authorities released a sketch of a man they term a material witness in a September 28th incident at the Lowe's store in Concord, North Carolina. A homemade bomb was discovered in the store less than 1 week after similar devices exploded inside Lowe's stores in two nearby towns. Richard Fox, division director with the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, says the man shown in the sketch is not currently a suspect.
He was in the store that day. What he saw, observed, or heard would be important to us.
Authorities have said the three Lowe's home improvement store incidents appear to be linked, but no motive has been revealed. For NPR News, Mark Rumsey, Charlotte.
Federal safety investigators have begun the slow task of removing the wreckage of golfer Payne Stewart's Learjet from a crater in a field in South Dakota. As of this afternoon, investigators said they'd recovered about a quarter of the wreckage, including some human remains. Six people, including Stewart, died in the crash. The National Transportation Safety Board hopes to find evidence to explain why the plane flew pilotless from Florida to South Dakota before running out of fuel and crashing. Part of the wreckage recovered today included oxygen masks. Investigators are focusing on a theory that the plane may have lost pressure shortly after taking off from Orlando. I'm Corey Flintoff, National Public Radio News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing soy and a variety of soy products to consumers around the world. ADM Supermarket to the world. On the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Barry White has been described as the maestro of love, the guru of love, the king of makeout music, and the high priest of boudoir soul. He recites, moans, and croons about love in a deep, mellow voice. For some listeners, this is very seductive. For others, it's camp. White had his biggest hits in the 70s, combining the sounds of funk and disco. More recently, rappers have sampled his music, and he's made guest appearances on Ally McBeal, where his songs are the soundtrack of one character's fantasies. Now he has a new autobiography called Barry White, Love Unlimited. He also has a new CD called Staying Power. Before we talk about his songs, his persona, the records he made for himself and others before he became famous, and his early life growing up in poverty, let's hear this 1974 hit, Can't Get Enough of Your Love, Babe.
I've heard people say that too much of anything is not good for you, baby. But I don't know about that. As many times as we've loved and we've shared love and made love, it doesn't seem to me like it's enough. It's just not enough, baby. It's just not enough. Oh, oh, baby. Oh, baby.
My darling, I can't get enough of your love, baby. Girl, I don't know why I can't get enough of your love, baby. Lord, some things I can't get used to, no matter how I try. It's like the more you give, the more I want. And baby, that's no lie. Oh, no, babe. Tell me, what can I say? What am I gonna do? How should I feel when everything is you? What kind of love is this giving me? Is it in your kiss or just because you're sweet? Girl, all I know is every time you're here, I feel a change, something moving. I scream your name. Look what you got to do with, darling. I can't get enough of your love, baby.
Barry White, welcome to Fresh Air. Let's start with your style of talking and singing. How did you develop that way of talking on your records? Were you more confident about talking than singing?
No, I'm very relaxed either way, singing or talking. I just felt as a creative person that when I did records, I would like to not only sing them, but explain them to a great degree also, so people would know exactly what I'm talking about.
What kind of comments did people used to give you about your speaking voice before you started recording?
Oh, I used to get a lot of different women and men, both. In elevators, there was always, when I asked for, when I would request the floor that I wanted, to get off of. Everybody on the elevator would turn around, you know. It was always like a big surprise or something, you know. When I'd call long distance and the operator would get on the phone before she would get me the number I was calling, she had to compliment me on the way my voice sounded. There's a lot of different things like that.
When did your voice get that deep, and what was your reaction when your voice started getting deeper?
Well, my voice changed when I was 14 years old, and I became a neighborhood freak for about a month and a half. And because most boys' voices change at 13, 12, or 14 years old. But my voice went from a tenor's voice to a baritone bass. And then a couple of years later, it dropped down to a bass baritone. So my voice just went through the changes it went through. And it's been the way it is today for a long time.
Now, you say in your book that when you were a teenager, your brother Daryl sometimes asked you to pretend that you were him on the phone so that you could talk to his girlfriends and do your thing on the phone with them. Did that work? Were they fooled?
Oh, yes. There was one time in our life before my voice really made that change of distinction. We sounded identical. You couldn't tell us apart. Only my mother knew the difference between us. And I'd walk in my door at home, and he would already be on the phone talking to his girl or the girl he's trying to impress, and he would just hand me the phone. I would stand there for about a half a minute, listen to what he was talking about, and then he'd pass me the phone. And I would pick up where he left off. And then a little while later, he would tell me to put my hand over the phone so she couldn't hear me. And he'd tell me what he wanted me to tell her, what he wanted to say to her. And that's what I would do, you know. And that went on for years. We did that for like 3 or 4 years.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Barry White, and he has a new autobiography called Love Unlimited and a new CD called Staying Power. Now, before you started producing Barry White Records, you produced the female trio Love Unlimited, and you write in your book that they expressed your female side. What did your female side want to express through this group? What did you see your female side as being?
Lyrically, mm-hmm. You mm-hmm. know, I wrote many songs for Love Unlimited, and Walking in the Rain with the One I Love was just a love song that anybody could have written, a man or a woman. But when I did the song I'm So Glad I'm a Woman, there was a lot of people saying to me, how did you get your mind together to even write some lyrics like that? You know, I've learned years ago that creativity is very unexplainable. It's very rare, number one, when people have it, and then it's even more rare when you can't express it. And that's what I meant by the feminine side, you know. I'm all man, please believe me. But I feel the women's side of things. I understand the sensitive side of women. My mother was very sensitive. I understood that growing up, you know, so it's not like I got here being grown or being an adult and then suddenly I start relating to women. I've been relating to women since I was a little boy, starting with my mother.
Why don't we hear Love Unlimited doing your song, I'm So Glad I'm a Woman?
All right. Just use what you got, baby.
That's Love Unlimited, produced by my guest, Barry White. And Barry White has a new biography and a new CD, and the CD is called Staying Power. Now, after producing Love Unlimited for a while, a trio of women, you wanted to find a singer to express your male side.
That's right.
What does that mean? What did you want to express through the male side?
No, I just wanted to write songs for male singers, you know. There's many sides to a creative person. It's not just this or it's just that. They have many sides to them. And I was trying to find a singer who could handle my songs as a lead singer. And little did I know that the guy I was looking for was right there inside of me, which I didn't want to really believe that. I really, really didn't want to believe that.
Yeah, why didn't you just produce yourself right away instead of looking for another male singer first?
I wasn't into singing. I wasn't into. I didn't want it that bad. I didn't want being a singer. I'm a singer. I didn't want that. I didn't want it that bad.
I mean, why not? What's wrong with being a singer?
No, it was just the stigma on it.
What's the stigma of being a singer?
Well, it's people, you know. It's people in the industry, I should say. The people in the industry looks down at a lot of artists. They don't respect them. They talk about them behind their backs. It's just a strange world, and I didn't want to be in that world. I just wanted to be creative and be behind the scenes. Didn't even want the lights on me. I don't want to be in the, because I'm shy by nature. I was just much happier behind the scenes than I was being a star of the show.
My guest is Barry White. He has a new autobiography called Love Unlimited. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Barry White. He has a new autobiography called Love Unlimited. Before our break, Barry White was saying that before he started performing, he was really more comfortable behind the scenes. Now, here's what I'm wondering. Were you in the control room a lot, producing and arranging, remixing, and listening to the people in the control room talking about the singers?
No, I'm listening to executives, vice presidents, presidents of record companies. Giving their opinions. They were always giving their opinions about different artists, their artists, other people's artists, you know, and it was always negative, you know, well, he's a crybaby, yeah, well, you know, if you get him enough alcohol, he'll do such, you know, it's a stigma. It's a thing that I just never wanted to be associated with.
So at what point did you decide, okay, I'll sing myself, I'll produce myself?
That came from my godfather, Larry Nunes. He and I, we went back and forth, and he told me, you've got to sing these songs that you've written. And I said, no, I don't want to sing them, Larry. You know, I don't want to be a singer, no artist and all that. He said, you got to do it, Barry. I've heard the songs. You've got a certain sound on the songs. And, you know, a whole production for almost a month of arguing. And he won out. I didn't win out. He won out. I mean, because of him, I'm singing today.
Well, let's hear one of your hits from 1975, and this is Love Serenade. Would you like to introduce it or say anything about writing or recording this?
I enjoyed it. Love Serenade deals with a guy and his girl, and he wants to get very intimate with her, you know, and he wants her to come to him in a certain way, looking a certain way, being a certain way. And Love Serenade takes care of that way.
This is Barry White.
Take it off.
Mm-hmm. baby, take it all off. I want you the way you came into the world. I don't want to feel no clothes. I don't want to see no panties. And take off that brassiere, my dear. Everybody's gone. We take the receiver off the phone. Because maybe you and me, this night, we're gonna get it on. To love serenade.
Barry White, Love Serenade, recorded in 1975. Now, you say in your new autobiography that women have always told their boyfriends that they can tell just from listening to you that Barry knows how to make love to a woman. I think what listeners really want to know is, when you're actually with a woman, do you talk that way in real life? Would you say the kind of things that you say in Love Serenade?
Well, that's my language. That's my dialogue. That's the way I am. That's nothing made up for records. All I'm doing on records is sharing to you what I think, what I say, what I feel as an artist on a record. I say those things and many other things to my woman. You know, that's nothing new to me or new to whoever I'm with. You know, I am a very communicative person, whether I'm talking about making love, whether I'm talking about everyday life, her life, our life together. I communicate. I believe in that. I strongly believe in it.
Now, do you think that there's been a lot of guys over the years who've tried to use your words to say things like, I don't want to see no panties, and take off that brassiere, my dear, and it comes off all wrong, and it just kind of blows up in their face.
Yeah, well, I'm sure there's been some guys that's tried to to imitate, emulate my words. I mean, the guys was doing that when I was in junior high school to other artists. And they're what they were singing, and they be trying to sing to the girls and all that, you know. Yeah, they do it. It's all in fun, you know. I don't see nothing wrong with it.
Barry White, did you ever see the film Taxi Driver?
Yeah, what about it?
Well, you know, Harvey Keitel plays a pimp and taxi driver, and one of his prostitutes is a girl about 12 or 13, played by Jodie Foster. And there's a scene in which she's particularly lonely, and she's thinking about trying to get away. And then the Harvey Keitel character, Sport, puts on some slow music, takes her in his arms, and talks to her in this really sexy, reassuring way. And this rap was something that Keitel himself came up with. I interviewed him a few years ago. I want to play that scene for you, but first I want you to hear what Harvey Keitel said when I asked him what inspired this rap.
Okay.
I took the idea from a Barry White song.
Oh, that's really interesting, because I always think of that scene when I hear a certain kind of Barry White song.
Yes, right. Well, that's where I got the idea from.
Which particular song was it?
There was no particular song, just his style.
I don't like what I'm doing, Swartz.
Baby, I never want you to like what you're doing. If you ever liked what you were doing, you wouldn't be my woman.
You never spend any time with me anymore.
Well, I got to attend to business, baby. You miss your man, don't you? I don't like to be away from you either. You know how I feel about you. I depend on you. I'd be lost without you. Don't you ever forget that. How much I need you. belong to me, baby. Let me hold you.
Barry White, what's your reaction to knowing that you inspired Harvey Keitel to do this scene?
That's a nice compliment, but, you know, that was a scene of a pimp and his lady. I don't speak as a pimp. I'm not a pimp. I don't relate to my woman as a whore or as a prostitute or any of those forms of things. I deal with my woman as my woman. I respect all women. I don't care who it is. My mother taught me that as a little boy, and I've grown up all my life with that philosophy. To be sensitive to what a woman needs, that's part of his rap that he was doing and with Jodie Foster. But evidently he wasn't being everything that she wanted. It was like she said, you're not spending enough time with me. So it's you know, you can say it any kind of way you want to. It works out in many different ways. Depends on who you're talking to.
Barry White. He has a new book called Barry White, Love Unlimited. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Grossen. This is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. And by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Reel.com, an online source for movies, offering over 100,000 titles on VHS and DVD. On the web at reel.com, AOL keyword REEL. From Crown, publishers of the novella by novelist Stephen Milhauser, Enchanted Night, a tale imbued with the power of the moon, available in bookstores. And from Saab, designing cars with a philosophy that performance and safety should go hand in hand. Information available at www.saabusa.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
You are different. Beauty's in the eye of the beholder, baby.
Coming up, growing up in South Central L.A., we continue our interview with Barry White. And Maureen Corrigan reviews the new novel by British writer Michael Frayn.
From all the rest, there's not a lot of things that can excite me, ignite me. You're all that, and then some. Your lips, your smile. Can I reminisce just for a while? Your eyes, your hair, everything I love. Got it right there. Your soft tone when you speak. Your sexiness.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
There is another problem, a bigger one. I have been unable to access him.
Who?
Him.
God?
No, not God. Barry White, I look in the mirror. I move. Nothing.
No,
I can't become one with him any longer. It's made me a lesser lover.
That's the character of John Cage on Ally McBeal. Barry White is the soundtrack Cage plays in his mind to feel sexy. Let's get back to our interview with songwriter, record producer, and singer Barry White. He has a new autobiography called Barry White Love Unlimited, and he has a new CD called Staying Power. I asked White how he and his records ended up on Ally McBeal.
Well, that was the Ally McBeal people on their own. There was no solicitation from me or no one from my camp. Called them to tell them to play a Barry White record. It wasn't like that. They played those records on their own.
How'd you find out about it?
And then one day they called my manager, Mr. Ned Shankman, and said, would Barry come on our show and do an episode? And I knew they had been playing my music, and anyone that supports my music, I support them. And I told Ned, yeah, I'd be glad to go on there and do an episode. And we went on and did it. It was beautiful. They're beautiful people, very professional people. It was a very, very, very nice venture. And I hope everyone that saw it enjoyed it. And I know that a lot of people saw it because when I travel around the world, everywhere I go, that's all that you can hear about it. Barry White and Ally McBeal. Ally McBeal and Barry White, you know. So it's a nice, it ended up being a nice working relationship.
Well, let me play a song that's been used on Ally McBeal, You're the First, the Last, My Everything.
Mm-hmm.
This is Barry White, recorded in 1974.
Yeah.
We got it together, didn't we? We've definitely got our thing together, don't we, baby? Isn't that nice? I mean, really, when you really sit and think about it, isn't it really, really nice? I can easily feel myself slipping and slipping more and more away into that super world of my own. Nobody but you and me. We've got it together, baby.
Barry White, recorded in 1974. Now, I really think that's a particularly good arrangement. Did you do the arrangement for it yourself?
Yes, I did. Believe it or not, that was a cowboy song.
What do you mean?
It was a cowboy song. Clunk, dee, clunk, dee, the little horse's hooves, and it had all the whistles and horns of a cowboy country and western song. You're the first, think of my last, dun, dun, my in-between, dun, dun, dun. And the writer, Sterling Reed Radcliffe, brought me the song, and he had been shopping it around the people for 41, 42 years, something like that. And he had been shopping the song around to different companies and different producers, and no one ever heard his song. He brought the song to me, and I told him, am I free to do whatever I hear that this song needs? He said, Barry, whatever you want to do to this song, he said, no one ever took interest in this song, man. So I took the song, and I changed the lyrics from You're the First, My Last, My In-Between to You're the First, My Last, My Everything. And then I wrote a melody for it, which was all mine also. Changed a lot of lyrics in the song, arranged it. That's one of my greatest talents as a creative force is arranging. So I went in the studio in 1974 and wrote the song and recorded it. You know, the rest is history.
My guest is Barry White, and he has a new autobiography, which is called Love Unlimited, and a new CD, which is called Staying Power. Let's talk a little bit about your childhood, which you talk about in your new book. You grew up in South Central Los Angeles.
Right.
What was the neighborhood like when you were growing up? And this was, what, in the 40s and 50s?
Yeah, in the 50s and 60s, yeah. It was rough. Things were very hard, but you learn how to live with it and get around it, you know, and that's what we did, my mother, my brother, and myself. And it was a heavy struggle, but we were able to, because of my mother, at least for me, I was able to understand a lot of things because of my mother's communications with me and my brother, constantly explaining things to us. It's hard to describe unless you live it, you know. You see people with that's enjoying a lot of money. Look across the street where these poor people are, and they wondering why they eat margarine and it's a different lifestyle. But you make the best out of whatever you got, and you go on, and that's what we did.
Now, you write about how you were arrested at the age of 15 in 1959. What for?
For burglary, for stealing tires.
Did you want to sell them?
Oh, yeah. We had fences all over Los Angeles, and anything we stole, we could get rid of within minutes. So we stole $30,000 worth of dual 90 tires, and my neighbor snitched on me. He saw us putting the tires in my garage, and he called the police. And I went to jail. I ended up going to jail. And if I saw that guy today, I would thank him profusely, believe me.
The judge. You thank the judge in your acknowledgments, in fact.
Oh, yeah. Not only the judge, the guy that snitched on me, I would thank him, too, you know.
Why?
It was a great change came over me in jail. So I'd never been locked up. I'd done a lot of crime and a lot of burglaries and a lot of GTAs and fighting and things, but I'd never went to jail for it. But this time I heard the gates close behind me, those loud-ass gates. And suddenly I was thrusted into my the lifestyle of my brother, who was used to going to jail. And I didn't like it. I didn't like nothing about it. People telling me when to get up, when to go to sleep, what to eat, when to eat. I had robbed myself of my privacy. And I didn't like that. I really didn't like it. And a lot of great things came to Barry White in jail. And only in jail could they have come to me.
Like what?
The way they did, with such impact. Because you have to sometimes, some people you have to really take away valuable things from them before they really understand how valuable what they lost really is. And that's what happened to me.
You mentioned that your brother had already been in and out of jail, and then he was given a pretty long sentence later on. And after he got out of prison, he was killed in a fight.
Yeah.
Did you ever look at him and think that could have been me if I took a different route?
Well, no, I didn't think that. I knew that. I knew that when I was 15 and 16 years old. I knew that anyone who chooses that life, that's the reward to that life. Every lifestyle has a reward. You want to go in the record business, fine. The rewards in the record business, if you're successful, is gold records, money, or platinum records, and more money, and people, or notoriety. You go into crime, that's a reward in there, too. It's time off your hands. It's freedom gone. There's a lot of different little surprises waiting for you in there. Everything has a reward for it. Crime, I didn't like the end result of crime.
My guest is Barry White. He has a new autobiography called Love Unlimited. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Barry White. When you were 17, you decided to quit school and go to Hollywood. What made you decide to do that? What were you hoping was going to happen?
Sweetheart, I didn't have the slightest idea. All I know is I went to bed that night fully prepared to go to school the next morning, the first day of the school, a new semester. And I got up that morning, and something in me said, the hell with school today, you need to go to Hollywood. So as I got up, I started saying to myself, I'm going to Hollywood today. I had no idea why I was going to Hollywood. I didn't know nobody in Hollywood. That's one of the things that broke my mother's heart, the fact that I was quitting school to go to Hollywood. And she knew I had no money, I had no connections, I knew nobody out there. That was one of the problems. But I had to go to Hollywood that morning, and I went to Hollywood. In fact, I walked to Hollywood that morning.
Because you were already in South Central, so it wasn't that far to go to Hollywood. You didn't have to hitchhike cross country or anything like that.
No, not cross country, but it's a long ways to a person that's never been there,
right?
And don't know anything about it. It's a long ways.
Well, really, your big break early on was that you got to do hand claps at a recording session. How did you get to do the hand claps?
Well, I was sitting in a session, and Leon Rene, which was the owner of Class Records, he was trying to get these union people to clap their hands in this syncopated timing in this record. And he hired five different people through the union. And these were union musicians. And they're supposed to have their thing together. Anyway, to make a long story short, we're sitting there, and I told my friend who I was there with, I said, I can do that. And he said, he just jumped up and went in there and told Leon Rene, said, hey, my friend said he can do this, the hand clap thing. So Leon Rene looked around in the room, and he looked over there at me. He said, well, who is he? And my friend said, Barry White. So he said, well, let him come on in here and see and try him on it. He played the record back. I did it in one take. He gave me the date was kept paying like $35 a person, union rules. He gave me a $100 bill. That was my first $100 bill that I made in the industry.
Was this right after the period when you left home for Hollywood?
Yes, it was. Yes, it was. This was the first money I'd made in Hollywood. This is like 3 months after I done left school. And, I mean, I'm out of school. I'm not going back to school now. I done made up my mind that morning when I said I was going to Hollywood. I was not going back to school. It was over. It was a sad mistake on my part because I later on realized how much I closed that door in my life by quitting school so close to graduating. That's what killed my mother. I mean, I had a few more months and I graduated out of high school. And I didn't want to graduate from high school. I wanted to go to Hollywood.
Well, it did pay off.
Oh, yeah. But what if it hadn't? That's how I look at it. You know, suppose I'd have been wrong. Suppose the boy in the dark who was going to Hollywood for whatever reason was wrong, and he went to Hollywood and nothing ever happened. There are thousands of children who go to Hollywood looking for great dreams and expectations and things that never happen. So if you're going to go to Hollywood, grab your paper from the school first, get that little education up under your belt, then go to Hollywood, you know. So if don't nothing happen, you can say, hey, man, I'm going back to school.
In the beginning of your book, you talk about how you write passionately about love, about how it's your theme. And, you know, you've been talking about how you really try to be honest in these things. And you say that this is the point that you're trying to make in your songs, that I'm here, my lady, you don't have to be sad anymore. Love will renew itself if you give it the chance. I'm here to stay. I'm not going anywhere. I'm going to be with you for a lifetime. On the other hand, you know, you've been, you know, married several times and have had been in different long-term relationships. Mm-hmm. So is that difficult to reconcile, that sense of, you know, saying to women in records or something, I'm going to be with you for a lifetime, knowing that hasn't really come to pass?
Yes, it will. Yes, it will come to pass. Let me explain it to you. When I tell a woman that I will be with you for a long time, I'm speaking about my music. It's not with me. Nobody lives forever. But the things and the deeds that you use or leave behind can live forever. The music that I have made, the music that friends of mine have made, Gavin Huff, Holland Dozier, and Holland, those songs will live forever. Music has a way of extending your life beyond your life. There are artists who are now dead. Marvin Gaye's gone. But I just heard Let's Get It On last night on the radio. Marvin is still here. The music outlives us, so, you know, that's what those statements mean. I'm not going nowhere. I am not going nowhere. My music will live beyond me.
I want to end with a track from your new CD, Staying mm-hmm. Power. Should we end with thank you?
Fine.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us. I really enjoyed it. Thank you.
It's my pleasure, Angel. Thank you.
And Barry White has a new autobiography called Love Unlimited, and here's music from his new CD, Staying Power.
All night long, everyday people sang a simple song. Papa's so excited, I'm about to cry. Sister out there shaking, can't believe my eyes. I wanna thank you for letting me be myself again. I'm
soul again. Dance to the music.
Barry White singing the Sly Stone song, Thank You. Coming up, Maureen Corrigan reviews a new novel by British writer Michael Frayn. This is Fresh Air. Playwright and novelist Michael Frayn has been called the master of what is seriously funny. Book critic Maureen Corrigan says Frayn's new novel, Headlong, is seriously good, too.
Michael Frayn's new book, Headlong, made me laugh out loud. And how often do you find yourself saying that about a novel? When I have, the novel has almost always been written by a Brit. Over the centuries, from Chaucer to Austen to both Amoses, the Brits have perfected a dry comic style, a kind of elegant verbal slapstick that's so deft it doesn't need to draw attention to itself. Call me an Anglophile, but lots of American comic writers whom I've read seem over-concerned that their readers aren't going to get the joke, so they wink and telegraph. Their novels are the literary equivalent of Robin Williams. The Brits, by contrast, don't care if the masses get it. Their snobbishness allows them the luxury of understatement. And speaking of understatement, the plot of Headlong has a lot in common with a television program currently a big hit on PBS that may be the most covertly comic show ever made. I'm talking about Antiques Roadshow, the British, not the far inferior American version. If you haven't seen it, it's a show where real people, everyone from the Duchess of Kent to the local bookie, cart their antiques to a public location. There, experts tell them whether the Elizabethan leech cup that's been in the family for generations is worth a fortune or a few pence. What makes the program so sadistically funny is the stiff upper lip demeanor of the Brits. Unlike the American version, where people whoop or snarl when told the value of their heirlooms, the Brits barely flinch. You've got to watch closely to catch their nostrils flare when the snooty Sotheby's appraiser tells them their grandmother's horsehair foot cushion would have been worth a fortune if only they had kept it safe from the damp. Headlong hilariously toys with that same fantasy of finding a gem among junk. A young philosopher named Martin Clay and his art historian wife Kate drive off to the country one spring for an uninterrupted stint of writing on their respective books. No sooner have they pulled up to their cottage, however, when the local squire, who's named Tony Chert, ambushes them at their door. Chert, Martin tells us, has the strong handshake of a man who's used to wringing the necks of wounded game birds. He invites the pair to dinner and won't take no for an answer. When the couple dutifully show up at Chert's ancestral pile, he oh so casually asks Kate to glance at some paintings rotting away in the breakfast room where he and their wife take their daily cornflakes and deviled kidneys. But it's Martin, who's been dabbling in the study of 15th century Netherlandish art, who spots the treasure that's currently serving as a soot trap in Chert's fireplace. He believes it's an uncatalogued Bruegel, a sixth landscape painting in a famous series often referred to as The Seasons. As soon as Martin sees the painting, he transforms from mild-mannered academic to altruistic art thief. Given the opportunity, the dim-witted, cash-poor Chert will surely sell the painting to the highest private bidder. Martin resolves to cheat Chert out of the painting and then bequeath it for a fair sum to the British Museum. Much ornate silliness ensues. Martin entangles himself in fix after fix, risking his marriage to erotically ingratiate himself with Chert's lonely wife, careening around London roundabouts in a long, long trailer filled with one of Chert's massive canvases. But two things make Headlong more than just a forgettable farce. First, there's the substantive and fascinating art scholarship which Frayn draws upon to make this tale of a heretofore missing sixth Bruegel seem not just plausible, but inevitable. And then there's Frayn's dead-on language, as well as his languorous comic timing. Because Frayn's humor depends on densely interwoven allusions and slow, witty build-ups, I'd have to read pages of his novel to give you a sense of why his writing is so very funny. I'm not even going to try. Instead, I'll rely on typical American overstatement and say that Headlong, like perhaps Chert's painting, is the genuine article.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, and Joan Tui Westman, with Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, and Patty Leswing. Research assistance from Sarah Scher. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Little Brown & Company, publishers of the complete stories of Evelyn Waugh, in hardcover wherever books are sold. From Reel.com, an online source for movies, offering over 100,000 titles on VHS and DVD. On the web at reel.com, AOL keyword REEL. And from BET on Jazz, premiering Future Wave on October 25th with host Herbie Hancock. Information, 877-733-5299. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the daughter of the King of Horror. We meet Victoria Price. She has a new biography of her father, Vincent Price. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.